The United States was not necessarily in favor of releasing the document because the CIA, back in the 1980s, was involved in providing this material to the Iraqis.
Just in our neighborhood, we are getting it. On average, about 7 to 8 people, those are being arrested every week.
The U.S. government looks at the problem only in terms of North Korea's failure to live up to past obligations.
I was taken on the plane to get deported to Pakistan, but a judge put a stop to my deportation, and it just felt like God took my soul for 1 minute, and the second minute I was given another life.
The negotiations take place behind closed doors. And one reason why those doors are closed, what goes on, is often so stupid, so immoral, so arm-twisting.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, January 10th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. For the first time, one of the 187 members of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty has pulled out. Ratified in 1970, the treaty is intended to halt the spread of nuclear weapons while promoting the development of peaceful uses of nuclear energy. North Korea asserts that its withdrawal, announced earlier today, takes effect immediately, although it would be willing to reverse its decision if the U.S. and its allies normalize relations. We spoke to Karen Lee with the Friends Committee on National Legislation in the East Asia Policy Education Project. She responded to North Korean Ambassador to the United Nations, Park Gil-yans, to his speech earlier today at the UN.
The NPT is being used as a tool for implementing the United States hostile policy towards the DPRK, aimed to disarm it and destroy its system by force. The DPRK government vehemently rejects and denounces this resolution of the IAEA, considering it as a grave encroachment upon our country's sovereignty and dignity of the nation.
A lot of acronyms there, but can you tell us what's your reaction to basically what the ambassador is saying?
As a member of an organization that works on peace issues, we see all of the non-proliferation treaties as our best bet for increasing the security of the world. We don't see them as tools that are used against specific countries. We see them as tools that should be jointly entered into by all countries in an effort to reduce the risk of nuclear war for the whole world.
Mm-hmm. What about the U.S.'s own record of compliance with the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, or the NPT?
Well, I would say my organization is as critical of U.S. efforts to expand its nuclear arsenal, to limit its funding for decommissioning nuclear weapons, for the use of depleted uranium-tipped weapons in the Gulf War. The Friends Committee on National Legislation is, in fact, critical of all these things, and it's why we look towards nonproliferation for the whole world.
North Korean Ambassador Park Gil-yan accuses the IAEA of double standards in its enforcement of the NPT.
I think the thing to remember when the North Korea is critical of the IAEA or of UN efforts is that the UN command, which was led by the U.S. during the Korean War, was a principal enemy of North Korea. So that Korean War has never ended, and so North Korea does not see the UN as a neutral body that is trying to treat all nations equally. It sees the UN as a hostile force that has been used by the U.S. before against it. So we might think, oh, isn't that good? The IAEA is coming in and they're saying what they have to say, and they would say that to everybody in the same way, and multilateralism is the way to go. But a according to North Korea, the UN is a hostile enemy, which has always been against it.
It is none other than United States, which wrecks peace and security on the Korean Peninsula and drives the situation there to an extremely dangerous phase. After the appearance of the Bush administration, the United States listed the DPRK as part of an axis of evil, adopting it as a national policy to oppose its system, and single out it as a target of preemptive nuclear attack, openly declaring a nuclear war.
Any response to that currently?
Well, I would say that, there's been a lot of blaming going on, and that, in fact, both sides do share responsibility for the current crisis. North Korea is clearly in violation of its agreement with South Korea not to pursue an enriched uranium program. And so one cannot exonerate North Korea from responsibility in the current crisis. At the same time, the Bush administration came into office and instituted a policy review, cut off dialogue with North Korea that had been very successful under the previous administration, has had only one high-level meeting with North Korea, which was in October when the enriched uranium program was discussed, and then said, okay, we're not going to talk anymore. And now they've said, well, we're going to talk, but we're not willing to negotiate anything. And what they've said specifically is we're not going to give North Korea anything else just for it living up to its past obligations. And when it makes that kind of a statement, it's not acknowledging that the U.S. itself has not lived up to its past obligations under the agreed framework. The U.S. had promised that it would say that North Korea is not a potential nuclear target. And, of course, the Nuclear Posture Review that came out last March did the opposite.
Mm. How much of a threat does North Korea actually present to peace in the region and actually to the world?
Well, I guess there's two ways of looking at that, or three ways. Right now, we're focused on nuclear weapons. I would say that for the people in South Korea, North Korea's conventional army poses a substantial threat. And so to people in South Korea, nuclear weapons, no nuclear weapons, they would still be the target of extensive devastation should there be a war between the North and the South. I actually don't believe that that North Korea wants to go to war. I'm just saying the technical capability that North Korea has.
Though we pull out of the NPT, we have no intention to produce nuclear weapons, and our nuclear activities at this stage will be confined only to peaceful purposes such as the production of electricity.
Well, there he's saying they have no intention of producing nuclear weapons. If North Korea is not planning to make any nuclear weapons, why do you suppose they took this step of withdrawing from the non-proliferation treaty?
Well, I would turn that around and say, you know, if the United States has no intention of using nuclear weapons on North Korea, why has it developed its strategy of preemptive strikes and talked about them publicly? Why has it done a nuclear posture review, which names North Korea as a potential nuclear target? I actually think that part of the statement, we have to greet it with a certain kind of, irony, because it seems that governments, including the U.S. government, often like to be able to have the potential while making the promise and see where it gets them. And I think that is part of what North Korea is trying to do. I also think that North Korea is responding to the very limited as I already mentioned, the very limited framework in which the U.S. has agreed to talks.
We consider now, any kind of economic sanctions to be taken by the Security Council of the United Nations against the DPRK is a declaration of war.
What's the next step then, currently?
For the U.S. side or for the North Korean side?
I think for the U.S. The U.S. has taken the stance that while it intends to wage a war in Iraq, it's still looking forward to negotiations with North Korea. What are the chances that a war with North Korea will be averted?
Well, I think when we woke up this morning and read the papers, we saw contradictory headlines. And on the one hand, we had the front page saying that North Korea was preparing to pull out of the NPT, which of course they did threaten to do back in the early 90s before the agreed framework was signed. What you see here is a division within North Korea about how best to handle this crisis. You have some people saying let's raise the stakes, and you have other people saying, well, let's get some advice on how to resolve this problem.
Karen Lee with the Friends Committee on National Legislation in the East Asia Policy Education Project. Well, today is the deadline for hundreds of men and teenagers of Middle Eastern descent in the U.S. to report to the Immigration and Naturalization Services in order to register. It's a new requirement under the new Homeland Security Act in the wake of September 11th. In the past, many have been detained and even deported without due process. In a dramatic series of events, yesterday, an American citizen of Afghan descent, Faisal Aldhi, was removed from a plane bound for Afghanistan after being deported by the INS. Federal agents entered his home in the middle of the night without warrants and took him into custody. He was housed in a New Jersey jail for weeks without any explanation of why he was arrested, and weeks later placed on a plane headed for Afghanistan. His attorney was, after a tremendous search, located him and issued an appeal to the media and Congresswoman Nydia Velasquez of New York. Yesterday, Federal Judge Patricia Rowan ordered Alvey's release, and a hearing has been scheduled. Alvey was on Democracy Now! This morning, along with the Congresswoman.
Well, let me just say this. I want to thank Juan Gonzalez and the lawyer. This is clearly a concerted effort of advocacy of so many people, particularly the media in some way. And it's really sad that now elected officials, journalists have to become the police. We are policing the system, a system that denied the most fundamental right of due process to individuals in this country. And that really worries me. It's really sad that a date like this come to, become a reality in this country. When Gonzalez approached me about this case, and then I read his column, and the lawyer approach, I believe, my staff, Liz O'Yon, and we sent out a letter to the INS here in New York. But when it became apparent to us that the day was coming where Mr. Vasul Yubi will be deported, I then called the commissioner, and I asked him to please support the lawyer's motion to reopen the case. And I made it very clear to him that this is an individual that was married to an American citizen with children of American children, and that I wanted for this individual to be protected and to be given the rights of due process. And if they were not willing to do that, then I will be on the phone calling both senators and other members of Congress and do a press conference and keep the pressure.
Oh, I'd like to ask Congresswoman Velasquez, what about this dragnet that Attorney General Ashcroft is doing with so many immigrants from the Middle East? Is there any kind of concern among your colleagues in Congress about the civil liberties implications here?
Yeah, there has been, Juan, and, it is important for the community to keep the pressure and to reach out to the members of Congress. Some of the judiciary members have been very active and in voicing their concern. They understand that mass deportation is really wrong, that we are not allowing procedural safeguards to take place, and that we are in the using a rush to judgment and circumventing the right that is in the law. You know, even if you are illegally here, you have a right to due process. You have a right to go before a judge. And what we are doing is circumventing that and deporting these people. As you know, Juan, we are facing a very conservative judiciary in our country, and it will take all of us to keep the pressure and continue to voice our concern and to demand justice for everyone. And this is an issue that every American should be concerned about. We cannot allow this to continue or to happen.
Nydia Velasquez, Democratic Congresswoman of New York, thanks to Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez of Democracy Now! For that report. Kareem Shura, legal advisor for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, or ADC, spoke with Peace Watch today regarding the required registration of men and boys over the age of 16 who entered the U.S. before September 10th or the 30th. The first group of immigrants from Iran, Iraq, Sudan, Syria had a deadline of December 16th. The event was fraught with disarray. The second deadline ends today. The second group mandated to report includes residents from Afghanistan, Algeria, Bahrain, Eritrea, Lebanon, Morocco, North Korea, Oman, Qatar, Somalia, Tunisia, United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. Saudi Arabia is included in a third group required to report. According to Shura, there was so much confusion that there are no hard and firm numbers of how many people are still being held. And tell us again why suddenly these individuals, these citizens, males over the age of 16, did you say?
That's correct.
Are being required to register. This sounds like unprecedented action in the history of this country, or is it?
It is somewhat unprecedented. It did take place in 1979 or 1980 with men from Iran after the revolution and the hostage situation that took place in Iran at the time. However, the reasoning is obviously national security. That's what the Justice Department is citing, saying after the terrorist attacks of September 11th, they're requiring or they're starting to require people from terrorist harboring countries or people who are most likely to be, I guess, terrorists. I'm not quite sure what the exact terminology is that they use. However, obviously, this does not increase our nation's security. It basically increases the size of the haystack. If you're looking for a terrorist in these communities, it's like trying to find a needle in a haystack. And by requiring all those law-abiding citizens who are lawful in the U.S. to register, you're simply just increasing the size of that haystack. There's a lot of stories that demonstrate, again, that the INS was not equipped to handle this. Their offices have interpreted the requirements and the procedures differently depending on the office. I've had U.S. citizens, for example. There's a story from down in Texas where a gentleman who's been a U.S. citizen for 20-some years, who is actually an attorney but not an immigration attorney, was on vacation with his wife. His wife was a Lebanese citizen with a green card, permanent residency. They were on vacation in Mexico returning through Texas. When they went through the INS inspection office, they were ordered to be inspected by the INS officer at that location in Laredo, Texas, because she looked at his U.S. passport. It said he was born in Kuwait, and so she said that he had to register or he could not enter the United States. They also required his wife to register. Now, there are so many mistakes with this. Number one, he's a U.S. citizen, therefore he's not subject to registration. Number two, his wife is obviously female. She's not required to register. Even if Lebanese citizens are, she carries a green card. Green card holders are not required to register. Now, I know that this specific story is under investigation by the Office of the Inspector General at the Justice Department because, obviously, it violates several steps in the registration program. Yeah. But there are many, many stories where, for example, people were not permitted to have their attorneys accompany them into the registration process. We know that's not correct. We know that attorneys have a right to accompany their clients into the registration process. And I can go on and on about different stories of people who obviously faced the wrong person at the INS.
Kareem Shura of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Recently, Iraq has reiterated its invitation from the CIA to inspect Iraq for weapons of mass destruction. The Boston Globe reported that about 100 United States Special Forces and more than 50 CIA officers have been inside Iraq for at least 4 months, possibly in breach of international law. Reem Kathuda, Pacifica's Peace Watch correspondent for WPFW, spoke with Wayne Madsen, the Washington, D.C. correspondent to Intelligence Online, about his experience with the USA intelligence agencies.
During the Reagan administration, I served a short term with the National Security Agency. And having a past with the intelligence community, I can sometimes separate the wheat from the chaff. When I cover a story, I try to go to the people I know who are pretty well connected with the decision makers in the intelligence community. Many in the administration in various positions do not necessarily agree with the administration's policies, and these are mostly not political appointees, but long-time civil servants and people who are working in the intelligence community and the military.
And regarding this build-up for a war on Iraq, the Iraqis have invited the CIA to come. Is this news to you?
I really think that Saddam Hussein, what he's doing there is saying, sure, CIA, come and check me out, because he knows they've been there before. In 1995, the CIA, using one of its front activities, attempted to stage a revolt in Iraq, mostly involving the Kurds, but also some dissident Iraqi generals, and also the Shias in the south. This revolt was a terrible failure. Saddam rolled it up. Many of the Iraqi agents for the CIA were executed. The CIA agents themselves were discovered and expelled.
And behind the radar, it seems that about 100 United States Special Forces personnel and more than 50 CIA officers have been inside Iraq for at least 4 months.
Yes, there's actually a coordinated group now, a Special Activities Division within the CIA, and they use a lot of former Special Forces soldiers in the Special Activities Division. For example, Johnny Michael Spann, who was the one Special Activities Division person who was killed in Mazar-e-Sharif in Afghanistan, was a former Special Forces officer. So they use a lot of these individuals in the CIA. They've been in northern Iraq. They've made forays also into the southern Shia region from neighboring Kuwait. They may also have a limited presence in Iran because of the so-called neutrality of the Iranian government. Iran's going through some tremendous problems right now between the hardliners and the moderates under Khatami, who, you know, want to improve relations with the United States and probably wouldn't be all that disappointed to see Saddam leave the stage because of the terrible war that Saddam waged against Iran, which included chemical weapons, which, of course, some of the components for those weapons were provided by the United States. This is why the United States was not necessarily in favor of releasing the document that Iraq provided the United Nations on their history of their chemical, biological, nuclear weapons program, because it turns out that the CIA, back in the 1980s, was involved in providing this material to the Iraqis who were fighting who was supposed to be our greatest enemy at the time, the Iranians.
What is really the role and the actions of the CIA when it's abroad in a country like Iraq?
What they're doing in the Kurdish area, the northern no-fly zone, is they're trying to cement the ties to the Kurdish regional power, which is a very tenuous alliance between the Kurdish Democratic Party, which after the failure of the CIA revolt in 95, allied itself with Saddam Hussein, figuring that this revolt was going to collapse and they better make a deal with the devil they know rather than the devil they didn't. And also the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan, headed by Jalal Talabani, who is very much aligned with the Iranians. So what the CIA is trying to do, either by paying people off, which is their modus operandi, it has been in Afghanistan with warlords with not very good success, paying people off for their loyalty, establishing bases of operations for the incoming American military. This would include airstrips. This would include basic intelligence vantage points, listening stations. Also, they'd be looking for potential generals who might defect, who might help the United States against Saddam Hussein. It's all done covertly, but as we know, the fact that they've been involved in establishing air bases in northern Iraq has been reported by newspapers.
Why would the Kurdish and other warlords in Iraq trust the CIA this time?
In my opinion, they have no reason to trust the CIA because, you know, there's the old saying, fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. They've been basically double-crossed by the CIA, not once, not twice, but three times. The first was in the 1970s when Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State at the time, decided to abandon the Kurds against Saddam in favor of a deal he made with the Iranians. This happened again during the Gulf War, where various U.S. propaganda broadcasts told the Kurds and the Shias to rise up against Saddam and we would go in and help them, and we never did. We conducted peace talks with Saddam, and there was a truce. He then went after the Kurds and the Shias. Then in 1995, there was the aborted CIA attempt to stage a revolt, which was a failure, and Kurds and many anti-Saddam Iraqis died.
Has anything changed in the operative or the ruling or direction of the United States to the CIA so that it would be different if now they're in Iraq?
The fact that the CIA has had all of its chains unbound from it by the Bush administration, they now have the ability to conduct all these various operations with a carte blanche, basically, from this administration.
When did this happen?
This happened shortly after September 11th, when George Tenet presented the president with what he called a worldwide attack matrix. He said, here are the terrorists we know about. I want the authority to go after these people, which would include assassinations. There has always been a ban on assassinations, especially of heads of state by the CIA, because of the abuses we saw with Lumumba in Congo in 1961 and Salvador Allende in Chile in 1973. These restrictions no longer apply, and recently the president signed a presidential finding which created a list of known terrorist leaders that the CIA can maintain and have as their wanted, as Bush says, wanted dead or alive. In this case, it would be wanted dead, not alive.
Doesn't this breach international law? As a matter of fact, doesn't the mere presence of these special forces in Iraq breach international law? Because it wasn't sanctioned by the UN.
The CIA activities normally are not sanctioned by the United Nations. This is what got the weapons inspectors in trouble in the first place when they were expelled, because it was found that U.S. intelligence had penetrated the original UN inspection team in Iraq. I guess when you're the world's only remaining superpower, you call yourself that, you have the ability to make the rules and not follow the rules. So we have Mr. Milosevic on trial in The Hague for extrajudicial killings of Albanians. We have people on trial in Arusha in Tanzania for genocide against the Rwandans. We soon will have an international tribunal in Sierra Leone to try people for the maiming and killing of children in that civil war. So I think as people could have done in the past in other countries like Germany, early on they could have prevented some of the abuses. I think the American people, they need to wake up.
Wayne Mattson, formerly with the National Security Agency, speaking with Reem Kathuda, Pacifica's Peace Watch correspondent for WPFW. Thanks to Tom Gomez from WBIX.org, Refugees and Exiles Radio Network, for help on this segment. We'll be back in a moment.